Hi, friends, and welcome to Reading Jewish History in the Parsha, where each week we share an idea in the Parsha and how it relates to Jewish history, along with all the books and articles I've read over Shabbos to learn more about it. Reminder to sign up for our weekly email through Substack, readingjewishhistoryintheparsha.substack.com, where you can get a write-up of our weekly class, along with all of the links to the articles and books that I've discovered on my Shabbos readings journey. So you don't have to email me. Where can I find that article? Just sign up for our weekly email, readingjewishhistoryintheparsha.substack.com. Thank you so much to our dearest friends and sponsors, Jana and Lior Hoden family, with immense gratitude to Hashem. My introduction to the prohibition of Lashon Hara, roughly translated as like negative speech, was with a song. Lashon Hara Lamed Hey, the song begins. The Lamed Hey, the Hebrew letters Lamed, then Hey, being the first letters of each respective word. Lashon begins with a Lamed, and Hara begins with a Hey. And the song, of course, concludes, if you haven't been humming it already, spell it backwards, that's where you'll stay. The latter part of the song is, of course, what stings most. For those who haven't either heard the song or worked out what the Hebrew letters Lamed and Hey spelled backwards is a reference to, I'll spell it out for you. Hey Lamed is a reference to hell. Spell it backwards, that's where you'll stay. If you say Lashon Hara, as the song said it from elementary school, you are going to go to hell. It happens to be a very charming, catchy song. If you hear it once in elementary school, it will stay with you for the rest of your life, as I'm sure many listeners could have finished that song. If you're hearing it now for the first time, and I can't imagine you are, but let's say a few of you are, I pray beside you and I apologize that it does not continue to ring in your ears. As harsh as the song may seem, is it wrong? Our Parsha introduces the concept of the Metzora, a skin affliction, which the Talmud states is a punishment for the sin of speaking Lashon Hara. The Gemara talks about this in Tractate Erchin on page 16a, 16b, Tezvav Amid Alf, Tezvav Amid Beis. The punishment certainly fits the crime. A Metzora is removed from the community and they have to dwell by themselves. Okay. That makes sense. As the Talmud explains, a Metzora must dwell alone because he has created loneliness among family and friends through negative speech. But dwelling alone is not the only part of the purification process for a Metzora. A Metzora must also take two birds. One is sacrificed and the other is set free. It's a strange part of the process that doesn't quite connect to the general theme of the Metzora as a speaker of Lashon Hara. Even the Talmud's connection seems inadequate. Birds are taken, the Talmud explains, because they chirp. So too, one who speaks Lashon Hara has chirped and chattered too much. It's a great allusion to Twitter, remember that? But why then does the Metzora take two birds, one sacrificed and one set free? To better understand all of this, let's explore how Lashon Hara and the very study of Jewish history intersect. When a notable person publishes their autobiography, let's be honest, we all read it with the same question in mind. Are they going to dish about the other famous people in their lives? No one reads an autobiography to find out the author's favorite food. And rabbinic autobiographies are no different, which is why it should come as no surprise that in the few rabbinic autobiographies that we do have, there has been a fair amount of controversy. One of the most controversial and fascinating rabbinic biographies is that of Rav Yaakov Emden, known as Megillas Sefer. Rav Yaakov Emden's biography would likely be classified today as oversharing. He is frank about his own sexual difficulties, his career slights, and his own medical issues. It sometimes sounds more like a podcast episode than a sefer. In fact, one reader was so startled by Rav Yaakov Emden's self-revelations that he insisted that the autobiography was a forgery. This can't be real. And wrote an entire separate work called Megillas Plaster, trying to prove that it was a fake. Of course, as Rabbi Dr. Jacob J. Schachter has decisively shown, it is very much authentic. So why share so much? As Rabbi Schachter explains in his fascinating article, History and Memory of Self, the Autobiography of Rabbi Jacob Emden, he writes as follows, in trying to understand these repeated unself-conscious and self-derogatory comments, one should not overlook the fact that a litany of Emden's multifaceted life's problems fits well with the other explanation he gave for writing this work. To publicize the extent of God's kindnesses and to give his fellow Jews strength and faith to overcome suffering. But not all autobiographies just reveal the struggles of the author. Many, and this is all the more true with the general study of Jewish history, disclose more sordid information about others that could and should rightfully make a reader wonder, is it okay for me to be reading this? To state it more bluntly, is reading negative stories within Jewish history a form of Lashon Hara? This question has been raised over and over again, especially when the sentiments of the rabbinic author may be out of sync with contemporary rabbinic attitudes and feelings. When the family of Rev Eliyahu David Rabinowitz Teumim, known as the Aderet, that's the acronym, Rev Eliyahu David Rabinowitz Teumim forms out the acronym Aderet, he was also the father-in-law of Rev Cook. When the family published a second edition of his autobiography called Seder Eliyahu, there were several passages that were excised, as recounted in Emanuel Etkus's fascinating work on shaping the image of the Gedolim in ultra-Orthodox Lithuanian hagiographic literature. That's the title of the article, at least in translation. It was published originally in this fabulous book that I have. It's all in Hebrew. It hasn't been translated as far as I know. The book is called HaGedolim, and it's edited by Benny Brown and Nisim Leon. It's a phenomenal book, and one of these chapters was from Emanuel Etkus. Again, his article, in translation at least, is called On Shaping the Image of the Gedolim in Ultra-Orthodox Lithuanian Hagiographic. Those are like the stories that we tell. Hagiographic literature. It's a fancy word used a lot. The editors of the new edition felt that the Aderet wrote a bit too freely, almost as if he was talking about someone else's life. So certain chapters in the life of the Aderet, most notably his poor interactions and opinion of Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector, who undoubtedly was the acknowledged Gadol Hadar at the time, were removed from the later edition. Essentially, the Aderet was upset at Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector for not recommending him for a certain rabbinic position. The humiliation, the Aderet writes, I felt from this incident cannot even be put into words. I've always had mixed feelings about such editorial decisions. I understand why such passages could cast important rabbinic figures in a negative light. On the other hand, reading a rabbi discuss their own personal professional frustrations could likely help someone else going through a similar situation. Still, the question remains, are such stories even permissible to share? My dearest friend and recurring mention in these shiurim, Zev Elef, discusses some of the halachic questions specifically related to Lashon Hara that arise from Jewish history in his Hebrew article. Again, I'm sorry, quoting so many Hebrew articles, not as accessible, but it's also fantastic. And the article is called On the Intersection Between Halacha and History. It may not be the same precise prohibition as speaking Lashon Hara of the living, but the Shulchan Aruch most certainly records, and I think it's in Hilchos Yom Kippurim, an early rabbinic enactment that prohibits speaking negatively of the deceased. Interestingly, the question of whether the actual prohibition of Lashon Hara applies to those deceased, this is what Professor Zev Elef argues, may hinge on a more esoteric question. Do we believe that dead people care about what is said about them in this world? Which is actually a question that the Talmud raises in the third chapter of Tractate Brachos. The feelings of the deceased aside, it is certainly prohibited to speak negatively of those deceased, either because of actual Lashon Hara or more likely because of this later rabbinic enactment. But who decides what is considered negative? What if sentiments change and what would seem honest, vulnerable, or just historically accurate for one generation is deemed inappropriate by the next generation? This question came to a very public debate in 1997 when the Torah Umada Journal, edited by Rabbi Dr. Jacob J. Schachter, published an article from Professor Mark Shapiro entitled Scholars and Friends, Rabbi Jechiel Jacob Weinberg and Professor Samuel Atlas, which published for the very first time correspondence between Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, sometimes referred to by the name of his responsa, which are called Sridei Eish, so sometimes he's called the Sridei Eish, and his old friend, Professor Samuel Atlas, who's on the Talmud faculty at the Reform Movement's Hebrew Union College. Atlas, an accomplished Talmud scholar in his own right, he published the comments of the Ravid, one of the great Rishonim that we have on Bava Kamma, was not the typical person associated with a world-renowned Orthodox rabbi. Beyond their unconventional friendship, much of the content of their correspondence was cause for concern for more traditionally minded readers. Professor Shapiro was well aware of the potential controversy their correspondence would likely cause. When one realizes that it is only with Atlas that Rev Weinberg felt comfortable in revealing his innermost thoughts, feelings, feelings and frustrations, Professor Shapiro writes, it becomes apparent that we are confronted with a relationship the likes of which is unknown in the history of Gedolei Yisrael. Some of their correspondence is typical. Rav Weinberg tells Professor Atlas to stick to the plain meaning of the text in his analysis, reminding him, you're not a Rosh Yeshiva. You don't have to say a shtickle Torah in your academic articles. They exchange writings and give one another feedback. But some letters are quite surprising. In one letter, Rav Weinberg shares his concerns about the state of the Orthodox community. This is what he writes. This is a translation. I am very distressed at the great fanaticism which has increased in strength in the Orthodox community. The Satmar Rebbe forbids studying Hebrew, and others say that the formation of the state of Israel was a sin which cannot be repented for. One writer protested that Rav Saul Lieberman was given the Rav Kook Prize due to the fact that he worked with the Reformers. On the other hand, they proclaim every Rebbe, which everyone knows is not outstanding in Torah knowledge, as a gadol and a Rosh Kol B'nai Hagola, which means a leader of the entire diaspora. For the members of Aguda, he's naming names, every unimportant rabbi who joins them is considered a great gon. In another letter, Rav Weinberg half-jokingly says that Professor Atlas, due to his fine character, is causing a chilul Hashem, desecrating the name of God. We see that one can be an upstanding and noble man, Rav Weinberg explains, even if one does not belong to the community of zealous Hasidim and is not punctilious about laws and customs. Perhaps most egregious was Rav Weinberg's concerns about the way Jewish law treats non-Jews. The entire world hates us, Rav Weinberg writes. We assume that this hatred is due to the wickedness of the nations, and no one stops to think that perhaps we also bear some guilt. Rav Weinberg then lists several halachos that make distinctions between Jews and non-Jews that troubled him. But what can we do, he concludes. Can we uproot our Torah teaching with apologetic formula or clever deception, he writes. God knows that I have written this with the blood of my heart, the blood of my soul. The publication of these letters caused quite a storm. In the next issue of the Torah Umada Journal, two letters to the editor were published. One, which was brief, questioned the publication of the letter regarding Jewish-Gentile relations. Why publish them in English where every anti-Semite can find them to his delight, the letter writer wondered. A much longer letter, in Hebrew, was published from Rav Avram Abra Weingart, one of the most prized disciples of Rav Weinberg. These were such personal letters, Rav Weingart writes. Had Rav Weinberg been asked, he certainly would not have given permission to publish. Publishing such letters, Rav Weingart felt, was a violation of personal trust. Aside from that, he added, it violated the aforementioned prohibition, what we mentioned earlier, of speaking negatively of the dead. Rav Weingart explains that Rav Weinberg, who lived through the Holocaust, lived a lonely life filled with suffering. He struggled with depression, and at times his only solace was confiding his concerns with his closest friends. Such ideas are not meant for publication. Rev Weingart signs his letter as a student who was like a son to Rev Weinberg. Most importantly, this issue of Torah Umada Journal featured a long article, just over 75 pages, where Rabbi Schachter reckons with his editorial decision to publish the correspondence. Entitled Facing the Truths of History, the article is an examination of how shifting standards and sensitivities should be considered in the way we relay Jewish history. If you have not read this article in its entirety, it is worth doing so this Shabbos. Read it this Shabbos, print it out, sign up for the emails, readingjewishhistoryintheparsha.substack.com. Click on the link. It's right there. It is an absolute classic. After presenting myriads of examples of stories and incidents that seem to demonstrate an uncomfortable relationship between communal sensitivities and actual, factual, historical truth, Rabbi Schachter writes as follows. In addition, does such behavior not betray an extraordinary sense of hubris? He's referring to the fact that we sometimes change the past in order to suit the sensitivities of the present. Are not all these later writers claiming that they know better than the Gaon of Vilna or Rav Hirsch or Rav Soloveitchik or Rav Zevin or Rav Bloch what appropriate Jewish behavior entails? Is it not a distortion of the Das Torah of Rav Zevin, for example, to admit those words of his about the state of Israel, which we actually discussed in this very sheer Parshas Bo, or that of Rav Bloch to his letter about the state? You could read the article to understand what he's talking about. Maybe they both wanted this information to be known. In indeed, what right does someone today have to come along and say that he knows better? In these circumstances, distorting the truth preserves the author's view of what he believes the Gadol should have been and not what, in fact, he was. I am reminded of a quote by James Russell Lowell. The mythic instinct ere long begins to shape things as they ought to have been rather than as they were. Still, even after Rabbi Schachter's impassioned defense of historical truth, Rev Weingart's letter, which we referenced earlier, as a faithful student of Rev Weinberg, gave Rev Schachter pause. Specifically, Rev Weingart's assertion that Rev Weinberg would not have wanted such letters published. Other of his more halachic concerns seem less compelling to Rev Schachter, but that concern resonated. Indeed, Rabbi Schachter writes, there is no one today who has an intimate knowledge of Rabbi Weinberg as has Rabbi Weingart. Still, Rabbi Schachter notes that once they have been published, the most important question to consider is what we can learn from them for our own spiritual lives. The article concludes with a request for forgiveness from Rev Weinberg, a request Rabbi Schachter in fact made on a special visit to his gravesite. Which brings us back to the Metzora. A Metzora brings two birds in the purification process. One is sacrificed, the other is set free. Rav Shlomo Gansfried, the author of the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, and my brother-in-law's great-great-great-great-grandfather, Shlomo Moskowitz, his great-great-grandfather was the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, writes in his work on the Parsha, Apirion, that the reason why these two birds are brought is to symbolize the ideal relationship to speech itself. The Metzora is guilty of speaking negatively. Corresponding to the negative speech of the Metzora is the bird that is sacrificed, symbolizing the grave consequences of negative speech. But that is not all. Another bird is needed. The bird who lives. Life and death are in the hands of speech, Rev Gansfried writes. It is not enough to just decry negative speech. We also need to bolster and encourage positive speech. And this is really at the heart of the very violation of Lashon Hara. Oftentimes, as the song indicates, spell it backwards, that's where you'll stay, our relationship with speech is framed in the negative. That, however, sorely overlooks the positivity that emerges from a kind word, an encouraging speech, and yes, sometimes even the truths of history. Some marshal history to tear down. Others can use that very same history to uplift, edify, and comfort. As Rabbi Schachter once told me in a conversation on 1840 about censorship and Jewish history, worth listening to, sometimes the stories that seem most unseemly can provide the most comfort when someone is struggling. My dearest friend, Rabbi Daniel Feldman, wrote an outstanding book on the laws of Lashon Hara entitled False Facts and True Rumors, Lashon Hara in Contemporary Culture, a must-read. He concludes his incredible work by focusing not on the dangers of speaking negatively, but on the proverbial second bird, the kind of speech that brings life. This is what he writes. The focus that has emerged in recent years on the study of the laws of Lashon Hara is a profound gift. A life devoted to understanding and refining commitment to these principles is a life of ever-expanding sensitivity, of ever-growing awareness, of ever-increasing appreciation of the complexity of humanity. It is a constant attention to the most fundamental needs of others in all of their diversity and nuance. It is a lifelong course in the finest points of interpersonal interaction. It is a mindset that forces the trivialities of life to recede and to fade while directing attention towards the genuine priorities in life, whatever they may be. It is a recognition of the endless capacity to grow, to improve, and to transcend a history of mistakes or misjudgments. It is an affirmation that humans must not be painted by the brush of their worst moments, and that the full picture of an individual will always be so much more than any other person can grasp at any moment. It is, in essence, to derive infinite potential through perceiving the infinite potential in others. So thank you again for listening to Reading Jewish History in the Parsha. To get the links to all the articles, books mentioned, be sure to subscribe to our weekly email, readingjewishhistoryintheparsha.substack.com. Thank you again to our dearest friends and sponsors, Jana and Lior Hoden family, with immense gratitude to Hashem. Thank you all so much for listening, and keep reading each and every Shabbos.